From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Okay, Tony, we have a lot of stuff to talk about. I'm very, very, very pleased to see that Lula did very well in the polls, despite the attempts to make him look bad that have been ongoing in Brazil by the media and everybody else there.
Yeah, and I find that very encouraging too, because it shows that, as in other contexts that we've seen, for example, in the United States and in Great Britain, the media while they do have a virtual monopoly, the mainstream media of news information, and the people are able to kind of get around that or yeah. get through it somehow.
Yeah, they're losing their control over the population. I'm loving it because they're getting real shrill too while it's happening.
As you said, what Ignacio Lula da Silva, the former Brazilian president, has achieved, given everything that they've thrown at him in terms of media hate campaigns, mm-hmm. media completely derogatory coverage of him, and the judicial attacks on him. Mm-hmm. And he's still coming out as he's something like 20 points clear of the nearest contender. And yeah, if the elections were held today, he'd win on the first round.
Yep.
Which is, in Brazil, that's quite unusual, you know. And,
I just hope he has good bodyguards, that's all.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And that's a very real danger.
Yep.
Because as the right wing realized that the rhetoric, their own rhetoric that they'd come to believe about kind of the end of the progressive cycle, you know, the progressive cycle of governments promoting the interests of the region's impoverished majority, that began, depends where you want to put the star, and it could be 1998 with the election of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and then you could almost say that that progressive cycle ended with the death of Chavez in 2013. Mm. I mean, if you want to put it in those terms, but that's what Chavez achieved is much more enduring than some kind of journalist slogan like Pink right. Tide or Conservative Restoration or any of that. And it's much,
right.
there are very, very deep processes going on, and Chavez gave an enormous boost to the political processes that champion the rights of ordinary people.
And if you look bigger also, beyond Latin America and the Caribbean, which is, of course, plenty big all by itself, 600 million people and, you know, yada, 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 you know, continent and a half, et cetera. Look bigger. Brazil on the world stage as one of the BRICS, you know, this alternate structure rising, you know, Lula gets lifted in Brazil. Of course, there's the natural processes that have been occurring there for, you know, maybe a century or two. Chavez paved the way for Lula in many ways, and also helped, you know, to sort of float that boat a little bit in a number of ways, politically and even economically. And, you know, you have kind of, if you look on the world stage, Lula and or Dilma Rousseff, Zuma in South Africa, and Modi in India, they are really large players, perhaps larger than they themselves, you know, conceive of when you think of the rising alternative to the global structure that's been more or less in development for the last 500 years or so. There's this rising alternative, and these are, you know, key parts of it. Certainly the people in Washington, Wall Street, London, Brussels, they know it because they attack it vigorously, repeatedly, constantly.
Yeah, and the challenge for progressive politicians throughout the region is, especially for people with a revolutionary agenda, is how do you make your revolutionary objectives? How do you get there from a context in which, and what's that saying by Gramsci? The old order has yet to die, and a new order has yet to be born. Something like that.
Yeah.
And so we're in this very, very complex stage of transition between the death of corporate capitalism dominated by Europe and North America to an age where we're not really sure how things are going to pan out, except that North America and Europe are finished in terms of being able to dominate the political agenda, the economic agenda, and the cultural agenda. But we still have very strong kind of traces of and influences of that long history. How could we not, after 500 years, you know, and that is affecting the way governments throughout Latin America and the Caribbean are able to implement what might otherwise be a much more progressive and or even revolutionary agenda. And you can see that here in Nicaragua, for example, where the government has felt bound in order. The key thing for countries, for vulnerable, economically vulnerable countries like Nicaragua, is stability. They're desperate for stability in order to build up the national resources, be able to exploit their national resources for once, finally, in favor of the impoverished majority. But they can't do that without stability. And you can see how the effects of instability almost overthrew the revolution in Venezuela.
Right.
So when people say, oh, we need the revolution and what's going on isn't revolutionary, and they need to look at, well, what happens when you try to implement that revolutionary agenda in terms of the response from a still very, very powerful forces of reaction in imperialism. You know, how do you deal with that? And if at a national level the consensus, like here in Nicaragua, the consensus is we want stability, we don't want more conflict. If that is the national consensus, and you say you're a Democrat, then how do you deal with that? How do you reconcile your revolutionary objectives with your democratic beliefs in this context now?
Yeah, that's right.
And so I know people criticize Daniel Ortega for the deals that he's made over the years, but without those deals, the question is, would he have been able to make the enormous social advances that the Frente Sandinista under his leadership and that of Rosario Murillo have achieved, and unquestionably here?
Right.
And they've completely diversified Nicaragua's. And it seems to me that diversification in all its senses is the key to the preservation of the chance of implementing revolutionary processes. Because what Daniel Ortega and his team have done is they've diversified their trade resources, they've diversified their diplomatic relations. You know, so they have relations with a wide range of countries, and in particular, they're putting a lot of emphasis on developing good relations with countries in Southeast Asia, in particular, but in Asia in general, and of course in China. And now, historically, what people may criticize Daniel Ortega and his team for maintaining links with Taiwan.
Right. But it's been very important for Nicaragua, those ties.
Yeah, and also it enables them to project an image that contradicts the imperialist propaganda that, you know, I mean, they're contradictions in the imperialist propaganda line. On the one hand, they decry Daniel Ortega because he's anti-democratic and all that stuff.
Right.
And on the other hand, his policies have made the kind of recipes of the World Bank and the IMF look stupid. And so and that's so that's and so by main by kind of keep he what Daniel Ortega does in some ways. I don't know if he's learned from Putin or if Putin's learned from Daniel and Fidel. And, you know, the interchange between these world leaders is kind of beyond our ken in many ways, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
So but he keeps the opposition off balance. He keeps the opposition off balance internally inside Nicaragua. So they've got something like 6% support nationally. And he keeps the opposition in the United States, in Washington, off balance by throwing curveballs that they don't know how to hit.
Yeah, that's right. You know, if you look at the relationship with Taiwan, that's also a two-edged sword. Having relations with Nicaragua, favorable relations with Nicaragua for Taiwan, you know, every independent relationship that Taiwan has makes it, you know, another inch or two away from being a direct colony of the West. And so, you know, in other words, it infects that relationship, you know, the relationship between Taiwan and the United States and South Korea and Japan and the EU, basically, because it's, you know, it's like having a, if not a foot in another world, having a toe in another world. And the potential for that, that's okay. No, the potential for that, you know, suppose China's, well, I mean, the relationship between China and Taiwan is evolving also and shall evolve, you know, and you're going to see some of those contradictions get resolved, I think, just with cross-border investment over the years. And, you know, suddenly the relationships that Taiwan maintains that are outside the, you know, the U.S. and EU, et cetera, they'll be valuable. There'll be paths for into and out of China.
Yeah, and Daniel Ortega, for years, has been a force in supporting the resolution of the confrontation between People's Republic of China and Taiwan, yeah. and also, for example, you know, looking at Korea, and Daniel Ortega and his government have been calling for peaceful resolution and on all sides to abandon nuclear weapons, at least in the peninsula.
Yep.
So, and that's, you know, so that's, and that goes back to what you're talking about with Modi in India and Zuma in South Africa, and they have these opportunities for developing an alternative. A majority world alternatives, political structures, economic structures, trade structures, and so forth. I think people like Daniel Ortega and Fidel, before he died, and now Raul and Raul's colleagues, they have a much clearer vision of where they want this multipolar world to go, right, in policy terms. And I think that explains a lot about why Nicaragua is so close to Vladimir Putin, whose distinguishing characteristic is the clarity of his vision and his determination to implement that vision, isn't it?
And, you know, there's another aspect, too. If you look at, for example, Venezuela being a leg upon which the left progressive forces inside Brazil could stand up in turn, allowing them to step onto the world stage as an independent actor to the extent that they've been able to do that. The relationship between Zuma, say, and Gaddafi's Libya, which Zuma at least acquiesced in, if not assisted in the destruction of it, you know, where Gaddafi was trying to take Africa would have allowed, you know, the Union of South Africa to also have, you know, assert sovereignty, economic self-determination, etc., with the various devices that they were looking to bring to Africa, such as its own currency and, you know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, the targets become these legs. Looking at take down the the global structure. You take out Libya, South Africa is essentially, you know, that hat in hand and hosting AFRICOM. And, you take out Venezuela, well, Lula's got a real hard time, and et cetera. I mean, and so you see that kind of a phenomenon, around the world. And then, you know, with India as well. I mean, there are things that can push India one way or the other. And you see the U.S. making a real hard play for military alliance with India, for example.
Yeah, and obviously in the context that you're talking about, the defense of Venezuela is absolutely key.
Yep.
And what you're talking about, and you mentioned before we started our conversation, a piece in Telesur reporting Evo Morales' comments on the JFK papers.
Yeah.
And unless I'm mistaken, what he's referring to principally was the revelation that the CIA had actually planned false flag bombings in Miami that they would later blame on Fidel.
Yep.
And the papers also, these JFK papers that have been released, also reveal the extent to which the CIA was committed to attempts to assassinate Fidel. You know, which just show how historic, there may be some slight change in the methods, not much, but the essential policy of the United States is that it has the right to intervene anywhere it likes, in particular in Latin America, which it still regards as its backyard. Although, is it Maria Zakharova, the Russian foreign?
Yes, she's a foreign ministry spokesperson. Yeah,
and she said, she said very clearly last week, Latin America and the Caribbean are no longer the U.S. backyard,
and they have
to get used to that.
That's right.
But these are processes, and you can see how they're playing out in each country, and each country has its individual characteristics. Venezuela has its individual characteristics. Colombia does, and as we've said, Brazil also does, and each country exhibits kind of signs of greater or less progress in terms of achieving social change and economic and commercial change in favor of the impoverished majority. And we just have to accept that process is ongoing and might not always go the way we'd like, obviously.
Yeah. Right.
So, but sometimes there was an article by a guy who's a very good writer, Marcelo Colussi, who I think he lives in Guatemala. There was an article I read where he was talking about, I think the title was Elections Are Not Revolution. Well, tell us something we don't know.
Right, that's right.
And how do we get to where we want to go from where we are? But people like Colussi or Raul Zibetti, for example, he's another one. You know, these very talented writers, great analysts of what's going on, but hopeless in terms of policy proposals. I mean, I don't want to fall into the banal bourgeois position. Well, what would you do? That kind of stupid response, because these processes are so complex. And I think we do have a right to demand at some level from the people that can criticize the leaders like Daniel Ortega or Lula da Silva. Lula da Silva has come in for a great deal of criticism from radicals, especially in North America and Europe, for being a moderate and for not being able to change Brazilian society as radically as they'd like.
Right.
What are they talking about? Brazil is, 300 million people?
United
States. And so with very, very diverse economic and social and cultural conditions across the country. And what Lula da Silva has achieved has been tremendous, despite whatever we might like it to have been. The problem, as we've seen in Ecuador, is how do you, if you have extremely talented leaders with great charisma, like Hugo Chavez and like Lula da Silva, like Daniel Ortega, Evo Morales, Fidel, and how do you ensure some kind of continuity? Now, in Cuba, they resolved that because they were lucky enough to have Raul and people like Miguel Diaz-Canel and people like that to take over the leadership. And Fidel actually resigned before he died, so that was tremendous.
And they had plenty of time, too, to, the revolution was in 1950, you know, the first day of 1959. And so they had, you know, some 50 some odd years to, you know, to get everything sort of straight.
That's right, Don. That's a very important point to make, because if you look at the time scale in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez only had, 15 years between taking office in 98, surviving the 2002 coup, and then the constant attacks against the revolutionary process in Venezuela before his death in 2013 that became even more intense after his death. You know, which is a huge tribute to the leadership of Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues there. Then in Brazil, you have something similar. And Lula's been around. He's been a revolutionary leader since the early 1980s.
Yep.
Right? And when did he finally win office? In the early 2000s.
Yep.
Something like that, wasn't it?
Yes.
And then he only had 8 years. Was it 8 years?
Yeah, two terms.
Two terms in order to implement changes in a country with the most reactionary oligarchy, perhaps, in the whole Latin American, certainly the most powerful reactionary oligarchy in the region in economic terms. And he managed to transform conditions for Venezuela's impoverished majority.
So on the point raised before, excuse me for one second, according to World Bank last year, the population is 207 million. That's still very large, population. Yeah. And he took office January 1st, 2003, and left office 8 years later, 2011, January 1.
Well. Yeah, and so then Dilma Rousseff is a much weaker character in political terms. I'm sure in personal terms she's a tremendous person, but looked at politically, she just did not have the influence and support and talent for negotiation that obviously Lula da Silva does. And because how is it possible for somebody in Lula da Silva's situation to survive, and he's been under siege for something like 3-4 years now. In terms of the judicial investigations that were begun initially to destabilize the government of Dilma Rousseff, they were hoping to be able to bring down Rousseff through criminal charges, but they were unable to. So they had to kind of rig this phony political process in order to carry out their soft coup.
Yep.
So that's the situation in Brazil. And if you look at all these countries are so different. I mean, look at what's happening in Colombia at the moment. There's been this very successful peace process initiated under the auspices originally of Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. And it was them that persuaded the FARC guerrilla to sit down and talk with their bitter enemy, Juan Manuel Santos, who was the Minister of Defense under former President Alvaro Uribe.
And they met, of course, in Havana for all that time.
Yeah, and just getting them to even begin to talk to each other was a huge political achievement. And actually bringing Colombia's almost 60-year civil war to effect to an end, because now the other main guerrilla force, the ELN, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional in Colombia, they are now in peace talks with the Colombian government. And I often ask myself, well, how is it that foreign radicals in the United States and Canada and Western Europe think that they know better than the leaders on the ground?
You got to look at their resumes too, because if you take a look at, your theory of revolution as applied in the United States has produced exactly what, you have to have. I understand that you don't want to get engaged in shadow boxing over, well, what would you do? But it's certainly fair game to say, what have you done that gives you the authority to critique what has been done here?
Well, and that's You know, and I personally find that very powerful, you know, and it's so easy for that to descend into kind of insult, and you know.
So then in
Colombia, and the misgivings that so many of us had about the peace process, because how can you possibly trust the people that are in government in Colombia given their record? I think you pointed out to me in another conversation that we had some time ago now that, you know, the record of betrayal of commitments by the Colombian government goes way back to the 90s, and then the key issue in Colombia is the paramilitaries and their political patrons like Álvaro Uribe. You know, and they it was the paramilitaries that under people like Álvaro Uribe, who carried out the massacres of the Unión Patriótica political party back in the 80s and early 90s, that wiped out the guerrillas' attempts to move to a political track, to move to an electoral party political track, and away from revolutionary guerrilla warfare. And the paramilitaries made sure that didn't happen. Well, now what's happening is it hasn't reached the levels of violence that would characterize the late 80s and early 90s. And there have been a couple of massacres and murders in a place called Tumaco, which haven't directly involved the guerrilla. They've been symptoms of the failure of the government to seriously implement the peace agreements. For example, one of the strands of the peace agreement in Colombia was a crop substitution instead of forced destruction of the cocoa growing areas in Colombia. And the incident in Tumaco involved anti-narcotics police who gunned down unarmed campesinos, unarmed rural workers during an operation that to forcibly eradicate cocoa plant production.
Right.
And that directly violated the letter, never mind the spirit, of the peace agreement with the FARC. So in addition to that, the government has been legitimately criticized for failing to implement other aspects of the peace process in Colombia. But even despite that, and the FARC leadership and the ELN leadership that have now joined, they issued a declaration called, in a place called Monte Cristi in Ecuador, the Monte Cristi Declaration, in which they proclaimed their commitment to peace. And they seem to be sticking very much to that. And they seem to be hoping that the United Nations and other international players, foreign governments that have assisted the peace process, they're hoping that that international pressure will make the Colombian government do what they signed up to do.
And we're going to have to see. Yeah, me too. We'll have to see how that goes. So, all right, Tony, we're going to follow that, of course, and see how it develops. And also, I'm hoping we can get into some of the other things going on in Brazil, for example, with these, you know, let's have some more secessions lining up in case we don't like the way things turn out in the election next year. Maybe we can see a couple or three Brazilian states vote to secede for real. The informal referendum that they just had. And thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and it's always very illuminating, and appreciate it.
Thanks a million, Don. Likewise.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.